This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the great environmental writer and activist Bill McKibben, who founded the group 350.org. McKibben's been writing on global warming for two decades now, first with his path-breaking book, The End of Nature, and then with many books in between, including his latest called Earth, which has an extra A in the middle of it, E-A-A-R-T-H. Bill McKibben, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here with you, friend.
It's great to see you again. What's with that extra A, by the way?
Well, first of all, here's the test. Summon your inner Schwarzenegger and try to pronounce it now.
Oh, I don't do a very good imitation, I'm afraid to say.
Sort of,
how's yours?
There
you go.
Look, the conceit is that the planet that we're living on is shifting beneath us, that it's already changed enough, global warming no longer a future threat but a present reality, that in certain ways it's quite a different place. The atmosphere holds about 5% more water vapor than it did 40 years ago. That means that we get deluge and downpour in unprecedented fashion. It's the 100-year flood every 3 or 4 years a lot of places. The ocean is 30% more acid than it was. We're living now through we've just come through the warmest global winter ever, and it looks like 2010 will be the hottest year ever recorded. It's a different planet already, and different planets require different habits if we're going to live on them. And so that's kind of what the book's about.
Yeah, the book is called Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. That's the subtitle. The Earth as we knew it is gone, you're right. You have a lot of real stark sentences like that, and I know that was intentional. You're a writer. You talk about writing in the beginning and in the intro here of your book, trying to deliver body blows, and you throw a lot of punches here. The Earth we knew is gone. And then there's another thing that you said, Bill McKibben. You said you talked about the pace of change being so fast that it used to be politicians and even scientists would say, this is something our grandchildren, we've got to do for our grandchildren.
We have to act to save our grandchildren. Forget about our grandchildren. This is us, you know.
You said our parents should have thought about this.
That's right. You know, if they'd done what they should have done 20 years ago, we'd be in somewhat better shape now.
Why have things gone faster than predicted? That's another theme here.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, when I wrote The End of Nature 21 years ago, we knew, A, that human beings were putting a lot of carbon in the atmosphere because we were burning coal and gas and oil, and we knew that the molecular structure of CO2 trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. So it stood to reason that things were going to heat up. The only question we didn't know was how quickly. Being human, I think, we hoped that it would take a while because then it would be somebody else's problem. But the Earth turned out to be more finely balanced than we anticipated. So far, we've raised the temperature about 1 degree Celsius, more or less. 20 years ago, we thought probably that wouldn't be enough to cause huge change. But we were wrong. Things like the very rapid melt of Arctic sea ice in the summer of 2007 shocked a lot of scientists. I got calls that summer from people I've known for many years. They'd always been worried. Now they were panicked. And pretty much any major physical feature of the planet that you name, the same kind of chaotic change is underway. When you look around and see it, the ground really is shifting beneath our feet. Now, it can be a lot worse than this. Just because we've crossed this threshold doesn't mean there aren't thresholds to cross. And so we've still got enormous work to do to slow down the amount of carbon we pour into the atmosphere. But we also better start figuring out how we're going to live on a degraded Earth.
We've crossed this threshold, you say, Bill McKibben. Is this the tipping point threshold that we used to hear people talk about?
There's going to be many tipping points or several tipping points along the way. There are some systems we've clearly perturbed too far for them to effectively recover. It looks like Arctic sea ice is one of those. We don't want to go further enough down this road that we, you know, deeply damage the monsoon rain system that feeds billions of people across Asia. We don't want to raise sea levels any more than we have to. These are the next sets of tipping points that we're creeping up on.
And what are the consequences in the here and now of this deterioration?
You know, the one attempt so far to kind of count up bodies was Kofi Annan's think tank, the Global Humanitarian Forum, did a study last summer that I think found about 300,000 people a year now dying of the effects of global warming, distributed across many different causes, but things like mosquito-borne disease that's on the rise. Though that's frankly a trivial number compared to what we're going to face if we don't get things under control very soon, because what we're talking about is the basic physical stability of the planet. The researchers in the last year have warned that we could face easily shortfalls in grain yields of 30 and 40% because it turns out that our main crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, are at least as adapted as we are to the climatic regime that they grew up in, evolved in. So we're playing literally with fire.
And so if that happens, I mean, a lot more people will starve to death.
Yeah, and a lot more people will be in the most basic kind of conflict over resources. Even, you know, I mean, people who we assign in this society to think about risk think a lot about this kind of stuff now. The insurance industry and, frankly, the Pentagon, who have begun, for better or for worse, to understand that the biggest source of conflict and chaos in the century to come isn't going to be, you know, terrorism from fundamentalists. It's going to be people on the move in search of enough food and water. India just finished building a 2,500-mile-long wall along its border with Bangladesh. Why? Because as the Bay of Bengal rises, there's closing in on 200 million people in Bangladesh, and a lot of them are going to need to find someplace else to go.
But that wall is going to trap them in.
It's not like India has a lot of vacant real estate, you know, in which to absorb a flood of people. Things like that around the globe are now moving beyond the realm of the theoretical into the very much here and now.
But even as they do that, the odd thing here living in the United States, if you read the opinion polls, is that more and more Americans don't believe that global warming either exists or, if it exists, that it's a man-made or man-contributed to phenomena.
Well, let's think how that could possibly be. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that the extraction of fossil fuel from the ground, its refinement and sale, turned out to be the single biggest industry in the history of humanity and the most profitable. ExxonMobil made more money each of the last 3 years than any company in the history of money. That's, you know, $40 billion a year, 40 billion reasons a year to do your best to delude, disinform. And, of course, when they do that, they're playing to a receptive audience. Not really very many of us are all that eager to change in real ways. You know, we'd like to continue floating along in the bubble that we've been in.
And that's the Sarah Palin bubble, too, the drill baby drill bubble.
Exactly right.
And ExxonMobil spent an inordinate amount of money to do PR to tell people that this
ExxonMobil, you know, California this fall will face an attempt to repeal its global warming law that's being funded by two big Texas oil companies. That's where all the money's coming from. You know, the coal industry spent a couple of $100 million last year on global warming propaganda of one kind or another. The scary thing is that they don't have to spend all that much compared to the amount of money that they're making. Our political system is so corroded with money that you can make a relatively small investment, and the payoff is unfortunately enormous.
I'm speaking with Bill McKibben, environmentalist, founder of the group 350.org, leading writer on the environment over the past 20 years. He's got a new book out called Earth, with an extra A in it, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Let's talk a little bit about making a life on a tough new planet. One of the first suggestions you make is the fundamental one that we need to move beyond growth, get used to not growing.
So 1972 saw the publication of the most read environmental book, or at least the most bought environmental book of all time. 30 million copies in 30 languages of that book, The Limits to Growth, a team of MIT computer scientists. And many people read it, and many people mocked it or reacted violently against it. The truth is, that's what we've reached. That's where we are. We're running up against precisely what they predicted at about the time they predicted, that the scale of our enterprise is now bumping up against the scale of the planet. When you melt the Arctic, that's a bad sign, okay? And that's going to be the most difficult not the transition from solar, from, you know, oil to solar power. The difficult transition is going to be the mental one, from a world where the answer to every problem is growth to a world where we have to mature and accept the idea that we're going to have to focus on resilience, on stability, on security instead. And if you think it's going to be hard here, I mean, the place where it's going to be just wrenching, painful, bitter is in those places in the world that haven't yet had their fair share of growth, world.
Yeah, Bill McKibben, let's talk about that, because that's what you call the justice deficit. And there seems to be two aspects to the justice deficit. One is the fact that the third world countries haven't been able to enjoy the growth that we have. If everyone had a fridge and air conditioning and a car like we have in the United States, you know, the earth would be melting even faster. And the second justice deficit is those people, masses of people, majority of people in the world suffer more from global warming than those in the north do.
There's an almost linear relationship, an inverse relationship between how much damage you're doing and how quickly you're going to suffer the consequences. So you go to Bangladesh, you can even measure how much carbon Bangladesh produces. I mean, the bicycle rickshaw is how people get around. And yet the country's, you know, it's submerging from one end, the glaciers that feed the rivers on the other are drying up, and in the middle everybody's getting dengue from the mosquitoes that are now swarming across the place.
And some of this concept about the justice deficit came out at Copenhagen, but Copenhagen was a disaster. Why?
Well, it wasn't a complete disaster. I mean, there were some interesting things that happened. We went into Copenhagen from 350.org with all this momentum. We'd just done this huge day of global action 6 weeks before that had seen 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries and had seen for the first time an environmental movement that was almost entirely poor, black, brown, Asian, and young, because that's what most of the people in the world are, you know. If you don't believe me, look at the 25,000 pictures in the Flickr account at 350.org, you know. We went into Copenhagen with a lot of momentum. We got 117 nations that signed on to this 350 target. That's the measurement in parts per million of CO2 that the scientists tell us is the most we can safely have in the atmosphere. It's quite a radical number, because we're already past it. We need to go back to get to it. At any rate, 117 nations signed on. That was great. They were the wrong 117 nations. They were the poor nations. The deeply addicted nations like our own weren't yet ready to come to terms, you know? And so they scuttled the process, more or less. So Copenhagen, in a sense, fizzled because a lot of poor countries weren't willing to just play along. In the past, the U.S. had said, oh, here's the score. Do what, you know, go along with our plan and here's some aid, you know. This time people were saying, guys, you know, we need the aid and we clearly deserve it, but if we're underwater, there's not enough money in the world to fix our problem, you know. So we need you to cut your emissions. And the Obama administration wasn't really ready to hear that yet.
Why do you think that is?
Because, well, they're answer would be because Congress isn't yet ready to hear it, and Congress isn't yet ready to hear it because, you know, there's not enough movement and pressure to counteract the oil companies. But also, you know, Obama made the calculation that he wasn't going to spend much political capital on this. He had other things.
What do you make of him coming out for offshore drilling?
Well, the best interpretation you could possibly put on it is that this is his gambit to, you know, his sort of offer to try to somehow get the intransigent GOP, one or two of them, to vote for some kind of climate bill. The climate bill that's on offer apparently is so weak as to be whatever. Even if that was Obama's gambit, I think it was a kind of strange one. You don't really want to ante, you know, put all your chips in when you ante. I think that it's becoming pretty clear that he's remarkably centrist on an awful lot of issues.
And how do we pressure him then? How do we pressure Congress?
I can't think of any way other than to build movements. I wish there was some shortcut. I mean, if I had ExxonMobil's bank account, I could think of a bunch of ways, you know. But lacking that, we're relying on people's spirit and creativity and bodies and whatever. On October 10th this year at 350.org, we're having this thing we're calling a global work party. And in thousands of places around the world, people will be putting up solar panels and digging community gardens and laying out bike paths, not, Matt, because we think there's any hope of solving climate change one project at a time. There isn't. We want to send a pointed political message. We're getting to work. What about you? If I can climb up on the roof with a hammer in my hand and put up a solar panel, you can climb up on the floor of the Senate and do your damn job finally, you know, hammer out some legislation for us. We're very tired of waiting decade after decade for people to address what clearly is the most difficult problem the world has ever faced and for which we have a unblemished bipartisan record of accomplishing nothing.
I'm speaking with Bill McKibben. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. Part of your book here, Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, Bill, deals with this question as to whether we can grow our way green out of the problem. And you seem to think that's not possible.
Well, we obviously need to put up a lot of windmills and solar panels. I've got them all over my roof. But the idea that we're simply going to substitute, you know, pull out the fossil fuel system, chuck in a bunch of windmills and continue on just as we are before is, I think, pretty delusional. That's incredibly expensive and time-consuming transition, even if we really get to work on it, which I hope we do. But B, this stuff's different. It matters. You know, physics and chemistry and things matter. Fossil fuels are particular stuff. It's concentrated in a few places. It's easy to transport. It's rich in BTUs. It led us to a kind of centralized series of systems, big coal-fired power plants, things like that. Renewable energy is very different. It's omnipresent but diffuse. There's some of it everywhere, but not much of it, or not a huge amount of it anywhere. So you have to adopt an exactly opposite strategy. You have to spread out. You know, we need a grid, an energy grid that doesn't work like the old, like, broadcast TV thing with three big channels pouring stuff at us. It works like the internet. Everybody putting stuff in, taking stuff out. My house, as I say, has solar panels on the roof. On a sunny day, I'm a utility. I fire electrons down the grid. That's good because you can put ecologically benign technology to work, like a solar panel, but it's also good because it's much more resilient and less vulnerable than what we've got now. If some terrorist is determined to take out my solar panels, he can. He can put a ladder up and climb on my roof and break them with a hammer, okay? But it doesn't wreck the grid. It doesn't spew deadly solar particles into the atmosphere. It's, you know, not that big a deal for anyone but me. We need, I guess what I'm saying is, just like we need a banking system that isn't too big to fail, we need an energy system and an agricultural system that isn't, in fact, not too big to fail. And we need those more, really, because in the end, food and energy are even more important than capital in how we order our lives.
Bill McKibben, you talk about this, a local energy grid, kind of like a local energy shed, like a local food shed or local watershed. Explain that a little more.
Well, this is sort of what I've been describing. Engineers would call it distributed generation. Lots of people. Think of the farmer's market, the same analogy, you know. Not one big Cargill or ADM bringing you all your food, but lots and lots of your neighbors, and maybe you're bringing some yourself. That's how we need to make energy work, too.
And you mentioned food, and there are a lot of exciting things happening with the farmers markets, with community-supported agriculture, with the slow food movement. Have you been surprised at how quickly that's taken off?
Well, it's been very gratifying. It's been fun to write about that over the years and play some small part in it. And it has taken off, and it's been very good to see. It won't go beyond – it won't become our mainstream food system until we do the thing that we have to do, which is put a price on carbon. That's the one sine qua non for making progress on energy, on food, in a big enough fashion to count. Once we do, once coal and gas and oil pay the freight for the damage they do in the atmosphere, then everybody will be going to the farmer's market, not just because it tastes a lot better, but because it'll become clear just how much incredible hidden subsidy there was to the fossil fuel industry. It'll be economically sensible, competitive.
But that raises again the political question.
Yes.
You know, how do you get the political system to put a price on carbon?
Yes. So part of that is building this movement that we describe, and part of it's being a little smart. So, you know, for instance, there's a bill in the Senate right now that's not getting much attention, probably because it's too smart for for Congress at the moment. It comes from two of our female senators, Senator Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, and Senator Collins, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine. And it's called a cap and dividend bill. Here's how it would work. You'd put a cap on the price of cap on the amount of carbon you go in the atmosphere. Exxon, say, would have to go pay a hefty fee at auction each year for the right to introduce that carbon into the system. They would therefore raise the price of gasoline at the pump. It would go back to $4 a gallon or whatever. That's good because that's the moment at which people suddenly realize, huh, I don't need a military vehicle in order to go get the groceries, you know. But if it bankrupts people, it's not good. So what the other half of this bill would do is take all that money from Exxon, put it in a big pool, and cut every American a check every 6 months for their share. It'd be kind of like what happens in the socialist state of Alaska, where they write you a check every year for your share of the oil revenues.
And does that bill have a chance of passing, you think?
Well, the bill that's going to come to the fore first is, being written by Senators Kerry and Graham and Lieberman. And they took the already corporatized House bill of cap and trade and have turned it into, I mean, talk about the sausage-making process. This thing is, you know, pure pork sausage, man, in every way. It's got so many gifts. It's like a huge Christmas stocking for coal and nuclear and offshore drilling. Lindsey Graham said not long ago, said, I'm all in favor of protecting the planet, but this bill is about energy independence. You know, I mean, they're not really even making much pretense anymore. But that's the bill that the serious guys talk about all the time. Basically, because in Washington right now, to be serious means to concede everything to corporate interest before you even start.
I'm speaking with a different kind of serious man here, Bill McKibben, who is the author of The End of Nature and Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. He's also founded the group 350.org that does great organizing around the world on this issue of global warming. You talk, Bill, about changing our mindset in a way, and you elevate certain adjectives and adverbs. You talked a little bit ago about a couple of those being resilient, for instance, but durable, sturdy, stable, hardy, robust is a list that you have in your book, and then you end with lightly, carefully, gracefully. Talk a little more about how we need to refashion the way we live along those lines.
Well, you know how in the wake of the financial crisis and the collapse a couple of years ago, all of a sudden people were less worried about making sure that their portfolios were growing, and much more concerned about making sure they actually had enough to, you know, that they protected themselves. In a certain sense, that's the realization that's going to start dawning on us as the physical world begins the same kind of runs into the same kind of hot water. That's what we're going to need to start thinking about. What do I actually need? And one of the things we'll figure out that we actually need a lot is much stronger ties to our communities. One of the things that fossil fuel has allowed us to do is become the first of our species to have no practical need of our neighbors for anything. Okay, and we've counted that as a plus. That sort of complete independence has been part of the recent American vision of ourselves. But it's a bad bargain in any event. It's made us unhappy. The lack of connection and community ties is the biggest reason that Americans report being far less satisfied with their lives than they were 50 years ago. The average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. So we're going to need, for very practical reasons, to rebuild those psychological ties that comprise a community. We'll need each other for things like food and energy. And in the process, we'll get at least a partial silver lining from what's going to be a wrenching transition. We talked about farmers markets a minute ago. The best thing about a farmers market isn't the cost of the food, it isn't the quality of the food, it isn't the fact that it's more ecologically sound. The best thing about a farmers market is when a pair of sociologists followed shoppers there a few years ago, they found that the average visitor, the average shopper, was having 10 times more conversations than the average shopper at the supermarket. Okay, that's the real difference. And of course, we pride ourselves on having invented this chic new thing, the farmer's market. This is how everybody shopped for food for all of human history until 70 years ago, and 80% of the planet still does. You know,
it's the way a lot of people still shop around the world. You recognize, though, that community sometimes can be stifling, and so you have a surprise kind of hero in the book.
That's right. I think the one great wild card we have going for us, the one thing that's breaking in our favor, is the invention of the internet. And I think for the first time, it's really possible to imagine, as someone who's lived all my life in small communities, possible to imagine staying home and having a very local economic life, and at the same time remaining very open and very connected to a larger world. And that's, you know, the window of the internet always open for new ideas to blow in and old prejudices to get blown out, so that small and local doesn't need to mean parochial anymore. That's a good thing that we're going to have to rely on. You can travel, you can do, I read the other day, 1,000 Google searches for the amount of energy it takes you to drive half a mile. Okay? We're going to have to figure out how to do a lot of our traveling via Google, and that's okay.
Bill McKibben has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. Bill, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, and thank you for all your good work, man.
Bill has done an incredible job organizing people around the world via the internet and by word of mouth through his organization, 350.org. So please visit www.350.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.